Welcome once again to another fantastic episode of the Business Creators Radio Show. We help business creators like you win at the game of business and marketing so you can thrive from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion and make a difference for your community, market, and audience. Please take a moment and visit our website, www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com. You'll find hundreds of episodes covering a breadth and depth of topics relevant to you as a business creator, and links to subscribe via your favorite network so you get fresh episodes delivered straight to you. And now, here's today's episode. Let's get started.
My name is Adam Homey, and I'm your host, and I'm honored by your wise decision once again to tune in and invest in yourself today. The Business Creators Radio Show goes where you go. You may occasionally hear ambient noise in the background, the occasional bird chirping, the car driving by, the conversation from a nearby table in a cafe. We go where you have the mastermind moments and the aha experiences that move you closer to serving from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion. That doesn't happen in an office. That doesn't happen in some soundproof, sterile Hollywood quality studio. It happens when you get out there in the field. You find it. You let it find you. Today, we broadcast from my sumptuous living room here in Las Vegas, Nevada, the hottest city in America. And we are going to be discussing why strategic planning is stupid. Okay, not so much, but more why you should take a serious look at the way you've been doing strategic planning. You may want to ditch it, and you may want to make some changes to it. You may also want to look at how to change your focus on in a way that'll maximize your impact and optimize the energy you put into it so that you don't tap yourself and get overwhelmed and burned out. As you can see, we have got a lot of things we're going to cover here. And to guide us on this journey, we have Sarah Olivieri. She's a business coach, strategist, with a passion for helping nonprofit organizations thrive, a number one international bestseller, and a former nonprofit executive director who now helps nonprofit teams as CEO and founder of her company, Pivot Ground. Her impact method is a framework that helps nonprofits simplify their operations, build aligned teams, and make a bigger impact without overwhelm. She has nearly 20 years experience with this. She also co-founded the Open Center for Autism and was the executive director of the Helping Children of War Foundation. She's also a published author who co-wrote Lesson Planning a la Carte, Integrated Planning for Students with Special Needs, and was a featured expert in the international best-selling series, The One Thing Every Mompreneur Needs to Know. Oh, boy. Sarah Olivieri, come on in. The weather's fine.
Did I do all that?
I'm not worthy to be in your presence, and this is my show. So I read off your official bio. First thing I want to know is, tell us in your own words a bit about your story and your journey, about what actually brought you to where you are, serving from what is very clearly your intersection of your brilliance and your passion.
Yeah, you know, this isn't the story of every entrepreneur, but I think it's the story of a lot of maybe mom or women entrepreneurs. I had already started like three businesses before I even applied that label to myself or considered I could be anything like that. But I started working in nonprofits, very much running a nonprofit's first conference. And then I was founding a nonprofit before I know it. I've been a first executive director of a newly formed nonprofit. I have also started a for-profit media production company, marketing agency. I've owned an art supply store and cafe, which I then turned into a cafe and co-working space. So I've been around the block a few times, and it was when I was running a marketing agency and I started focusing on nonprofits that I realized the nonprofits mostly couldn't benefit from great marketing because they didn't run very well. And then I started diving into how can I take what I know of nonprofits and what I know about running a for-profit business and help nonprofits run better. And what I learned was, first of all, I'm in love with how businesses operate, period. But nonprofits are one of the most complex business models you can have. And so it's very exciting, interesting to me personally, but it also means all this stuff actually applies to all businesses. Because if you can do it in a really complex situation, you can do it in an easier situation, and it works very well as well.
Okay. I have a question for you. First of all, I want to get your thoughts on a phrase I've been saying for years, is that there's actually no such thing as a nonprofit. What there is a such thing as is whether money goes to shareholders or to reinvestment. I see these models, they're called nonprofits. They may have 501c3 status. I've worked with clients who serve the nonprofit industry, so I have some familiarity. But the theme I see again and again and again is they don't want to lose money. They actually want to take in more money than they put out. Otherwise, they cannot reinvest. They cannot serve their charitable function. They cannot continue to expand and broaden the net that they're able to cast over whatever issue it is they're looking to lasso and make the change that they want to see in the world.
Yeah, I mean, if I were to have my choice of renaming what we call this sector, I would call it the impact first sector. Okay. So, you know, from a legal perspective, right, the reason why you're able to get, you know, nonprofit status means you don't have to pay tax on your profits. It certainly doesn't mean you can't have profits. And you're absolutely right. Legally, the trade-off is nobody's allowed to actually own a nonprofit, and therefore they can't take part of the profits out. They can't sell part of the profits. You know, they can't sell a share to somebody else, right? So no individual can own a nonprofit. That's the trade-off for not having to pay taxes. But I think where it gets a little different from the for-profit industry is in a for-profit, if you can't make any money, or if you're going to not you know, you're going to close, or you're going to change your business model. And nonprofits have to make money. It's fuel. It's very important that they reinvest and that they keep making money and that they have money to use. But they may sometimes, they may quite frequently choose activities that put impact at a higher value than profit. So they're balancing those two in a much more intense way than a for-profit business ever would.
Well, certainly. I get that. And part of it is indeed cultural. I was on the board of directors for a nonprofit myself. I was also the president of that same organization. And I had some of these really crazy ideas, one of which was, in fact, that the organization should take in more money than it put out.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
They looked at me like I had five heads. Meanwhile, I'm fighting with people who are supposed to be organizing programs who can't even call the venue in a timely fashion to reserve the room. But they have this big mission. They're going to make a big difference. So I think part of what happens is, candidly, when you get to this place where people feel that they're part of something that's not for profit, it's not about corporate greed, that they can lose their business sense, because after all, the kumbaya will make it right.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think that there is this, I was just talking about this yesterday. I was leading a retreat for board members and saying, you know, the nonprofit industry just perpetuates this message of it's supposed to feel hard. We're not supposed to have money. We're not supposed to spend very much money. We're not supposed to take any risks. And that actually numbs all these signals that we need as business people, right? When it starts to feel really hard, that should be a signal that something is going wrong. If we don't have any money, that should be a signal that something is going wrong. But because we're always telling nonprofits that they're not supposed to have money and it's supposed to feel hard, they don't receive that warning sign that something's going wrong, and it gets worse and worse and worse and can go, you know, very far being terrible. You can have the 25-year-old startup nonprofit that's never made it out of startup phase. That doesn't happen in the for-profit world.
Right. Where I'm headed with this is I really want to know, and we'll start broad and we'll bring in the focus wherever our conversation takes us. But you say that we should ditch the way we've been doing strategic planning. All right. What's going on with that?
So in the nonprofit space, and this happens in corporate, large corporations as well.
Oh, yeah.
Nonprofits are doing, traditionally, they've been told to do strategic planning. Kind of every 5 years is the norm right now. It used to be like 10 years. Some are like, oh, we'll do it every 3 years. Here and there, there's someone saying, hey, maybe we should look at our strategic plan every year. And I really advocate that, one, if there is an industry, a sector in the business world that should be known as the very, 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 very best at innovating, it should be the nonprofit sector. They're solving the world's most complex problems. Therefore, they should be the most innovative. And if you're going to be extremely innovative, you better be agile. You better be great at experimenting. You better be able to turn on a dime. And that means having a very iterative strategic planning process. And so what I teach my clients is in the impact method is a process where we're updating strategic plans every 2 months. So that's a radical shift from like
every 5 years. Every 2 months. Holy hell. I like it, but holy hell.
Yeah. Well, you know, originally I looked at the quarterly model. You know, a lot of for-profits kind of run on a quarterly schedule. And I just found that when the rubber meets the road, when you're actually living a quarterly schedule, that last month is always a little fuzzy. You start to feel like, what are my goals again? You know, it just isn't top of mind. But 2 months is always top of mind. You know, 8 weeks is easy for your brain to hold on to.
Eight weeks is nothing, by the way.
Yes, right? But you can remember 8 weeks. You can remember your goals.
You're not gonna forget it. 8 weeks will be with you that entire 8 weeks. As of the time we're having this conversation, we're near the end of August, and it feels like we're still toward the end of June.
That's right. It goes so fast. So especially if you've got like kids in school, like, oh my God.
Oh yeah, certainly. Or if you are that kid, you're hoping back to school never comes. Yeah, it seems to come earlier and earlier every year.
Yeah.
It doesn't really. They just learn to appreciate school even less, and who can blame them? But anyway.
That's right. My son would totally agree. He hates school. I grew up loving school, but I went to a very fun school. So
yeah. Same thing. The educational system did not work out for me, and I can tell you, if you could ever collect the biggest group of losers and assholes and get stuck in a classroom with them and be abused by them for 12 years nonstop, somehow they found all of them and assigned them to me. The funny thing about that whole thing, and this actually I'm bringing this up for a reason, it's coincidental we got to here, but we do bring it up for a reason, is with the education system, like if you participate in public education, for example, and you send your kids to the local school district, you have basically, you're putting your child or children into an environment where they're arbitrarily assigned a group of peers that they may, which was my experience, be the one group of people in the world that they have the least in common with. Like they have more in common with literally people they've never will meet than they do with this group. And then you expect them to deal with them for 12 years, even if it's a hostile, toxic environment that they can't wait to escape from, which is my case. Now you go into the work world and your classmates are sometimes replaced by employers. Mm-hmm. You go into the nonprofit world and you can have a couple different things in my personal experience. One of which could be it's more that same thing because maybe you become an employee of a nonprofit. It's basically just a job like any other. It just so happens the company has 501c3 or similar status where they don't have shareholders and nobody takes money out as taxable income. On the other hand, when we hear the term nonprofit, it has the connotation of people who volunteer, who all actually want to be there for a reason other than either assigned geography or somebody's got to do it. You get a sense of people who feel they have some sort of personal investment. So even if there's nothing else in common, y'all got that one thing in common. You do want to save that particular genus of whales.
Yeah. Nonprofits have a huge advantage in hiring because of that. But, you know, all businesses and nonprofits, too, suffer from that educational system you were just describing, because the educational system is extremely hierarchical, the kind of command and control structure. Yep. And everybody learns that, and then they just apply it to the business world. And I teach, you know, another part of the impact method model is teaching an alternative way of managing what needs to get done in your organization. And it's, you know, proven again and again that, you know, oligarchy isn't really necessarily the best way to get people to do things. Just, you know, saying you have to do it or I'm going to fire you or penalize you doesn't actually motivate people as well as giving them agency and a certain level of autonomy and letting them naturally form community, which, like, humans are hardwired to be community people, right?
Yeah. Like, there's a reason I'm laughing here, Sarah. The reason I'm laughing is because here we are in 2022. We've got the great resignation or great realignment or great everybody's changing jobs thing or whatever you want to call it. Then we have the thing where we have the presenteeism. Now, some people are saying that means people are slacking off, and other people are saying they're saying that means folks are looking at their lives saying, wait a minute. I'm getting paid for 40 hours a week and I'm doing this stuff on nights and weekends and I'm missing my kids' ball games and academic team meets. No. You pay me for 40 hours, you get 40 hours. Beyond that, pay more. In fact, I even said this to a client on the personal consulting side of my, or the private consulting business that I have, which is very limited scope in terms of how many clients I bring in. And, we're beginning to embark on another project that we're going to be collaborating on. And she wanted to know what my bandwidth was. And I just said very simply, the amount of money you put in determines the amount of bandwidth I have. So the reason I was laughing is you say to somebody, do it this way or you're fired. They say, cool, fire me. Oh, by the way, your competitor just made me a job offer. So I was going to quit. Bye.
Right. People aren't standing for it. And the sad irony of it all is the way of running your business that makes people happier is also the way that's been proven to make it more profitable and more effective, right? So it's a win-win if we can let go of this kind of power-focused people trying to control people methodology and replace it with something I teach, you know, in nonprofits, we get focused on outcomes. I call it replacing people in charge of people in charge of tasks with people in charge of outcomes. And you don't actually have to, like, manage people beyond if the outcomes aren't happening, then you got to change stuff up. And if they aren't happening because the people aren't doing their tasks, which isn't usually a problem if everybody has input on what should be done and feels like they were heard and valued, then usually people do what the job is, unless they're, like, sick or something totally reasonable.
Certainly. Now, we have a whole bunch of terms, formulas and things that you gave me a list of in the green room that we're going to go through here in the rest of our time together. And for our listeners, this is one of those things where you just kind of want to understand how mastermind conversations really work. They don't necessarily follow a syllabus. They go where they go. That's the format of the Business Creators Radio Show. But I do have an observation I want to make for you, particularly when it comes to getting people to do things based on command, manage, I think you said it was, or something along those lines.
Yeah, people in charge of people in charge of tasks, or command and control.
Right, right. So in my book, Groundhog Day is an Event, Not a Business Strategy, I argue that there are two ways to get people to actually care about deadlines. Number one, when they turn something in, actually act on it. Because if they do work for you and they turn it in, they never hear about it again, you can pound the desk about deadlines all you want. But the fact is people want to feel that what they're doing is useful and valuable. And if they're not seeing it put in the marketplace or put to work, they'll find somebody else's deadline to care about. That's number one. Number two, create dependencies. It's very easy to look in the mirror and say, you know, you totally just blew off that entire big project that was supposed to be due today. We'll just have some ice cream. We'll feel better. You can forgive yourself. But if you not doing that caused Sarah over there to have her entire itinerary wrecked, and is going to throw her into the floodlights because now she can't deliver on her piece of the project. Well, then you're just the jerk. So
that's right. Yep.
I mean, we can have a broad range of being willing to forgive our own shortcomings, but as far as the level of integrity that most people innately have is, even if they themselves are slackers, they don't want to be seen as having let somebody else down.
Oh yeah. Such a powerful motivator.
Yeah. Now one other thing, and this, you know, we talk about strategic planning and what that gets translated into, whether, you know, regardless of where the extra money in the company goes, is it comes down to, okay, so what project management system do we use? And you've got Asana, Monday, Teamwork. Oh, I could go on forever. And everybody listening probably think, oh, but you didn't mention mine. Yeah, whatever. Okay, here's the point. Selecting project management software, and I want to get your thoughts on this.
Oh, exciting. Yes.
Yeah. unless you want to pay developers $3 million to build something that has this one tiny little thing that you just can't seem to get anywhere else, and supposedly your whole organization is going to come to a stop without, which is never the case, by the way, then you, if you can basically go by these criteria, you'll have picked the right one.
Sure.
It needs to solve whatever issues in your business or help you manage the projects you have now. It needs to anticipate to the best of your ability what needs you're going to have within, say, the next 6 months. I mean, you talk about planning in 8-week increments. That's basically three of those periods.
Mm-hmm.
So yep. Still not a lot of time, but enough you can hold on to it. The third is it needs to effectively deal with asynchronicity. Asynchronicity, yep, of personalities, work styles, time zones, times of day that people work, on and on and on and on, and allow for the effective management of dependencies to track where a project is and enable people to receive the handoffs of data. And the most important thing is it has to be fun for people to use. Because they don't enjoy it, they're just not going to do it. And they will very quickly put you in a situation where you have a choice of dealing with the fact that they're not going to use your project management system or replacing them, not the system.
Yeah, yeah.
Got to be fun, or even you're not going to use it.
That's right. And I would add, for me personally, I need to use the minimum number of tools. So I actually build my strategies in the same tool that I build my project management. And it's the same tool that I have my task list. Cause I've used two tools, and the result is when I get busy, I don't open the task list. And if I don't open my task list, I don't do my work.
You're absolutely right about that. You know, simplicity, limiting the number of tools we use. And the other thing is, I have a protocol that I have multiple computers, desktops, laptops, tablets, smartphones, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. For me to be able to use something, it has to be something I can access seamlessly from any of those applications, which means I could be on my laptop 1 minute and then over on my desktop 90 seconds later. And yeah, it would be like I never even moved, because I could just save as and go pick up somewhere else, or if I'm in the middle of a conversation, I could switch from one to the other and I wouldn't even have to say BRB.
That's right.
Yeah,
I agree.
And yeah, which is why I don't use Slack, and I won't participate in Slack. It's very simple. It's very difficult in real time to have that multiplicity. And the other thing is if you log off from it, unlike pretty much every project management software out there, it doesn't send you an email to ping you when something's going on. So you have to install an app on your machine. Now, maybe that's changed, but this was my experience every time I've looked into it. Somebody's wanted me to use Slack. When I was first starting with Rotary, and I had to spend a year on the newbie club, one of the members had the idea, well, let's set up a Slack for our newbie club where we can chat about things and we can work on projects together. I said, dude, number one, it's Slack. Number two, it won't send me an email. Number three, this is a meeting I reluctantly attend once a week, and every quarter I'm obligated to volunteer to stand at the door at a social event. I am not making this a workflow.
I love that. You know, I'm actually not a Slack fan either. Yeah. And I feel like it encourages too much conversation. And like that, I'm like, I don't have time to look through all this stuff. I don't want it all connected. I don't want to it's like stream of consciousness is how I feel about it. And I don't need that. I just want to get stuff done. I want less, not more. And I've used a lot of the tools you mentioned. I've used Asana. I've used Teamwork. I've used Trello. Some other ones. The tool I use now is Zenkit.
Yep, I've heard of it.
Yep. And I use that for one very, I've used ClickUp. there's one thing that Zenkit does that none of the other tools do. And for that reason, I forgive it all its other weaknesses, which is that, you know, in most of those tools, you can have some side of card, right? And the card or item is going to be your task, or maybe that card is the collection of tasks that make a task list. Right. Well, in Zenkit, those cards can also be displayed as a mind map.
Yeah.
One of the things that I learned over the years in goal setting and strategy building is that having different views to build your plan and then to look at your plan is really, really powerful. And you can then build processes around using views that can really enhance what you're trying to figure out. So for example, like, first of all, let's just go back to basics for a second. Like, when we're talking about strategy, people throw that word around like, oh, I'm going to be strategic, or what's your strategy? And they misuse the word strategy a lot. They use the word strategy often when they mean tactics, like things that you're going to do. But strategy is a two-part situation. Strategy is goals, things you want to accomplish, and tactics or actions that you're going to take, the way you're going to try to achieve that goal. And when you have both goals and ideas about how you're going to achieve that goal, then you have a strategy. Just ideas about achieving things is not a strategy, and just goals is not a strategy.
And I think part of that comes from command and control, which then radiates into our workplace. Here's an example. You go to a school and you are putting classes that are 46 minutes each, that you spend exactly that same amount of time going from subject to subject to subject to subject. You are programmed to learn for the test. I've shared on other experiences about how my experience being forced into math classes that I couldn't even handle was to me basically a form of child abuse. And I know that's controversial, but that's how I feel about it.
Yeah.
And for all the agony that that caused me, to the point where, and where it came from is I was classified as gifted. So it was assumed because I was gifted in most things that of course I could do trigonometry and algebra and calculus. And for all the energy I put into something that I was not innately good at, that I hated, that I already knew, whatever my career path was, it wasn't going to be this. I was forced to spend 90 to 95% of my entire academic time just trying to pass it while being told about how lazy I am and I need to start applying myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I missed out on the joys of the other 95% of the work where, okay, I didn't need to work real hard to get A's and all those other things.
Because it's all tactics and no goals. No one was saying, you know.
Nobody told me what, other than, you're going to have a job someday where you're going to need to measure triangles and you're going to need to solve for X. Okay, measure for triangles, I'll hire a carpenter. Solve for X, that's what I have a CPA for. He loves math.
You know, you'll appreciate, I was always very good at math and I started with a very fun math program and I was doing college math in high school. Yep. But as soon as I got into college, I had the second class I took, the college one in high school, the professor said, oh, mathematicians, we don't do mathematics. If it anything with a number larger than 3, we don't touch it. And you know, I think there are a lot of people who don't like numbers who need to hear that actually advanced mathematicians, they don't like numbers either.
That's very, very interesting. So take that one step further. And this idea that we are taught things in units and increments of the exact same length, that we go to a school from exactly such and such a time to exactly such and such a time, 5 days a week, excluding Act 80 days and holidays and summer breaks. And you see some of the school districts are now moving toward breaks throughout the year. Instead of the 2.5 months during the summer, they break it up more throughout the year. So you get natural spring break, you get a break, you get a real end of the year break, that sort of thing, which I think is a better model personally. And now going be it now, the next step is now this gets brought into the workplace where there's this expectation of folks who have no particular need to are herded into cube farms and told that they have to somehow be their best and brilliant between 8 a.m. and 5 p.m. Monday through Friday and be visible and answer your phone on the second ring and respond to all emails promptly within 15 minutes and make sure to CC senior management in the correct order, unless you want to have meetings about the meetings about how to CC people and have this take up 25 years of your time. So
it's all such a waste, so silly.
In my first few years as an entrepreneur, I dealt with, and this is because I didn't have really have my avatars nailed down to the type of clients I wanted to work with, the ones who would email me or leave messages and then tap their watch and attempt to grade me by how quickly I responded. I said, that's really cute. I probably used other words. And then there was another one. It's like, well, what are your office hours? I don't have office hours. If you've paid me for us to do something, we set goals, we set benchmarks, we set milestones, we set deadlines. And if anything needs to pivot along the way, we're in communication. We get it done one way or the other. If you tell me we need something, I'll give you an example. We have one of our new podcast reach clients who's getting ready to graduate. And part of their project is to get their intro, outro, and commercials bumpers done for their episode production. I told the client that we would have those ready in advance of a one-on-one I was having with the client on Friday. So that naturally means that we delivered the drafts to the client at my equivalent of about 11:30 p.m. Thursday night.
Yep.
You want to know why? Because I planned my entire week around being able to disappear from society for a few hours that Tuesday to come up with the themes, the schematics, the expectations, and access art and such to give to the programmer so that they could give me the files back by Thursday. And then there was a little bit of time if we need to go back and forth on small edits.
Yeah. Yeah.
That didn't happen anywhere within the hours of 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., I assure you.
Well, I think, you know, you mentioned asynchronous, and I took note of that. I think that, you know, I've been running a totally virtual business for many, many years now. But I think what a lot of people don't understand about both working virtually, remotely, and basically most of digital marketing and digital communication, except for live conversations like we're having now, is it's asynchronous. And that comes with some disadvantages, but it also comes with a lot of advantages, right?
Yeah. Like
there's a lot, you can keep a chain reaction going and work could be happening continuously 24 hours a day with no one person having to kill themselves. I mean, people are like, oh, Sarah, you get so much done, you know, like you must, I'm working on my 3 day work week. I'm going to be working from like 10 a.m. to like 2 p.m. kind of 3 days a week, you know, but my hours aren't set, but that's just kind of my basic goal. And I'm flexible. Sometimes I like working. So, you know, sometimes I work more because it's fun. Sometimes I do tasks that, you know, are low level tasks because they're fun and relaxing.
Finish your thought and then I have one for you.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
No, finish your thought.
You know, so that's one of the joys of being an entrepreneur, of being a business owner, but I think it can also be the joys of almost every team member in a company because people are happier and people are more productive when they have that kind of like, I'm doing this work for a meaning, not to log an hour.
Yeah. So what I wanted to bring up is you mentioned doing small rote tasks. Mm-hmm. Science shows that that helps to optimize your brain when you need to do deep work. So when I have something deep I need to do, like I have writing I need to do, or I have an immersive project I need to do, I budget time to, well, candidly, goof off.
Yeah. We call that brain time with my clients.
Exactly.
Like, you need precisely, brain time.
Precisely. So it's to the point where a few people who follow me fairly closely on social media, they say, oh, he's posting about all these theoretical things and he's all over people's threads, jumping into debates and such. He must have a big deadline. It's gone to the point where one buddy of mine will notice me doing this and then he'll DM me and say, all right, man, what you working on?
Mm-hmm. He knows. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And going back to my thing about how our educational system forces us to agonize over the things we don't like and are not good at, and then calls us lazy when we still can't achieve. Meanwhile, denies us the opportunity to enjoy the stuff that we can master without a lot of effort. You mentioned earlier that it seems like, and I'm paraphrasing you, that folks look at, say, working in a nonprofit, and it's, there's supposed to be a struggle because we're supposed to be on a shoestring. And then you go into many corporate and team type situations, they say, well, this is supposed to be a challenge. We're supposed to run into roadblocks. Why?
Yeah.
I was at a seminar once, and I can't remember if it was actually his seminar or if he was the keynote or whatever, my friend James Malinchak, and he explained the difference between working hard and working smart.
Mm-hmm.
So what he attempted to do is we're in this conference room. I think there were 300 people in there. He tried to leave right in the middle of his speech. So he explained, all right, I'm going to work hard to get out of here. He went up to the wall and started pounding it with his fist. And surprisingly, he wasn't able to punch a hole in it. So then he said, oh, look, there's a door. I'm going to go work smart.
Yeah.
So he went up to the door and started pounding on the door with his fist. It's like, well, I'm working smart. I know if I pound on this door, eventually it's going to give way. And then he reached down, put his hand on the doorknob, turned it, and opened the door. And he said, see, now that is working right.
I love it.
So we talk about work hard versus work smart, but what about work right? Why does it have to be so hard? If you want to get out of the room, you find the nearest door that has a handle and turn it.
And you leave it. I think that it's like that culture of we've always done it that way. It's like the wall, right? That people are always running into. Uh-huh. And that comes from a command and control type environment, right? I do it because I was told to do it. And if you create a culture, environment, processes, whatever you want to call it, where I've always done it that way is never a reason to do something because I want to get this result is the reason you do everything. Then you don't have people pounding on the wall. You have people opening doors. And all of a sudden, like, this is how that kind of culture turns into having a lot more money is all of a sudden people just are walking through doors and opportunities are happening. And it didn't take that much time and energy. And everybody's happier and more relaxed and everybody has more brain time.
Yeah.
And then they come up with better solutions. And it just like perpetuates in a very positive cycle. But people are terrified to make that change.
Well, yeah, whenever I hear that's how we've always done it, my usual response without any further fact finding is to say, yeah, and somehow despite that, you've managed to squeak through until now. Congratulations on somehow making it. So with that, let's pivot here because you gave me a couple other things I want to make sure we definitely get in that are really intriguing to me. You mentioned to me in the green room the importance of having a superpower of being brutal in your priorities. This is something I would love to spend at least 5 minutes sinking our teeth into. Take me away because I love this topic.
Yeah. Well, if you're going to set a goal and try to achieve it, well, one is you have to prioritize your goals, right? So you can't achieve all your goals at the same time.
Right.
You have to actually pick the one, or if your company's big enough, the two or three goals that you want to achieve first. And you have to really focus on them, and you have to free yourself from all of the other junk, let's call it. I call it crap, you know, stuff that really doesn't need to be there. Nobody said you had to answer all of your emails. Nobody said you have to, like, people putting all these rules on themselves and then doing all this stuff following these rules, none of which help you achieve your goal. I think, you know, if you've ever worked with a coach, and me as a coach, one of the first things I do with any client, especially if we're working one-on-one, is tell them what to take off their plate. You can stop doing that. You can stop doing that. You can stop doing that. And sometimes, like, that's where I had that thought around being brutal about your priorities, because the things you may take off your plate might be surprising and they might be scary. Like, oh, I'm going to stop doing that. Yes, you are going to stop doing this thing, you know, like straightening up your files or making sure, you know, I like organization, but things don't need to be perfectly neat, right?
We just
so that we're not confused.
You know, a couple of things I think of. I remember this one time I tried an experiment. I just didn't answer my email for a week. And you know what's funny is that the things that actually mattered and the clients and the people who had made themselves important enough to me that anything affecting them could possibly affect me had other ways of getting a hold of me waiting that week wasn't enough. Now, I didn't announce anybody that was letting my email go for a week. I just did it.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to see how this happened. The clients who actually had, you know, actually had a sense of, well, this is really important to me, also recognized that they had the currency with me. They had other ways of getting my attention. Now, when I did this experiment, there was the one who apparently I'd found out that they had sent me an email that Tuesday with the word urgent in the subject line. and when I saw it like 6 days later, I said, oh, sorry, I was out. They said, they started with this whole thing of, you know, I need to be organized and focused, and how could I be so irresponsible? I said, if it mattered, you'd have picked up the goddamn phone.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as an urgent email. There's no such thing as an urgent text. And if you have any questions as to whether or not you could actually pick up a telephone and dial somebody and expect them to respond and be of help to you, if you're not sure that you've achieved that with them, you haven't.
So one of my earliest jobs when I was in college, I had a job as a hair salon receptionist. And I learned a very important business lesson from this salon owner. She said to me, Sarah,
"Oh, this should be fun. Go ahead."
Yeah. She said, "You have to train your clients that they have to book an appointment," right? This is a high-end salon. That even if we have availability same day or on a walk-in, you say no. You turn them away. You book an appointment for another day. Because if you start letting your clients think that they're going to come. Now, you'd think there would be no hair emergencies. But there were supposed hair emergencies. I had a client call up. "I need to get in today. It's an emergency. I have to go to a funeral and my roots are showing."
Like, that's not really an emergency.
That's also not an emergency.
It's also not an emergency if you're going to be in somebody's wedding. Because unless they just got engaged the day before and they're eloping the day after tomorrow, you knew about it for a year.
You knew about it. There are no salon emergencies, right? Period.
There are only two examples. One of which is you're going to be in a wedding where the couple literally got engaged yesterday and they're eloping tomorrow. Then I could see that as being an emergency.
And if you can at least get it patched up.
The other is if somehow you managed to literally set your hair on fire and you need it at least fixed up until it can grow back.
Right.
Those are the only two things I can see as being emergencies.
So training your clients, and the way I use this lesson many years later is that I tell, you know, most of my clients are CEOs. They're like the prime leader in their organization. And I like to tell them, listen, like, you control the speed at which the conversation happens, right?
Yes.
If this conversation is truly important that to you for your priorities, that it happens quickly, then by all means respond right away. But most incoming requests to you are not going to be your top priority. And if you respond right away, you're setting a fast pace and it's going to be annoying because you don't want fast in your face if it's not a top priority. So don't respond immediately, right? Which is the opposite of what we were just saying. People are trained, like, you have to respond right away. And here I am saying, don't respond. You set the pace. If you want one communication a week, respond once a week. If you want one communication a day, respond once a day. You know, but you have to control that pace. Don't let that feeling of urgency when somebody emails you with a request or asking something set the pace. And
exactly.
Now, don't ignore people, but you can always write back saying, I got your email. I'll get back to you next week.
And you know, some of my private consulting clients actually just asked me to just do that, to just say, hey, got it. Just so they know it didn't fall into the vortex of being gobbled up by the email gremlins.
Right. My clients know I respond to their emails that they've submitted by Monday on Tuesday.
Yeah.
Well, sure, so I don't have to tell them because I trained them all
within
a response on Tuesday.
Within a business day is standard turnaround, and people who pay me a certain amount of money, which is lots, also know that if they get on my Skype or they get on my social media DMs, I'll respond to that in timely fashion.
Yeah.
Because they've earned the currency with me to be able to enter my life at that level by giving me money. And it's the same with the people who I pay to render services for me.
Yeah.
I have that privilege with them that others who don't pay them don't get.
Yeah. I think somebody, I forget who it was, you know, one of the most valuable things you can pay for is access to somebody who has expertise, right? And paying for that access is really valuable.
Also, the definition of celebrity.
Don't understand that, right?
Yep. Also, the definition of celebrity. It's access. And I've met a fair number of celebrities. I've had friends, actually really good friends, who were top 40 recording artists. And the recurring theme of how I met them all is buying a ticket to go to some event.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just a matter of access. And some of the folks back from where I grew up and everything's like, there was this one time I met John Ratzenberger, who played Cliff Clavin on Cheers.
Mm-hmm.
And I posted a picture of me with John the morning after I met him. It's like, whoa, how did you meet him? That's amazing. Boy, man, you're going places. I paid $75 to attend a dinner. He was the keynote speaker.
That's right. You can buy yourself access, and I
got to have a really nice conversation with him. I explained to him how I agree that Cliff Clavin's answer on Final Jeopardy was correct and he should have won, because those three people had never been in this kitchen. And I also became the first person to ever tell him that Cliff Clavin inspired me.
Nice.
He couldn't figure that one out even after I explained it to him.
That's great.
That's a story for another time. So I'm going to leave that loop open for our listeners. Maybe in a future episode, I'll cover that one.
I think the whole topic of, you know, paying for access is way under discussed.
That sounds mercenary, but it's really not.
I used to go to nonprofit galas to meet potential clients. Now, I don't think nonprofit galas are a good form of fundraising, so I kind of stopped doing it because now I'm kind of perpetuating something that I actively tell people not to do. And it's kind of an awkward introduction to be like, I'm here to tell you to stop doing the thing that you're doing. Yeah. Plus, the pandemic made fewer galas, and my clients are all over the country. But it was just straight up, I'm like, if I can pay $150 to have a direct one-on-one experience with my target person who I want to sell to, I'm going to do that.
Absolutely. All right. So we've covered being ruthless with our brutal on our priorities. And in the time we have left, and we're unfortunately getting near the end, we might have to have you back in a few months to get into some more stuff, because it's so much fun. But, But the next thing that you brought up that's really got me curious is you mentioned the chaos theory. And part of what we've been talking about here is the idea of looking at things less from command and control and more from a community standpoint. So when you got community and you've got people actually working out each other's boundaries, working out how to best be of service to each other, how to work effectively in asynchronous threads, you're going to get chaos. So chaos theory, how it applies in business.
Oh, there's a couple things here. So I was early on very inspired by Margaret Wheatley, who wrote a book called Leadership and the New Sciences. I had to look back to see the book. Leadership and the New Sciences. And she's the one who started using this term chaos. She was actually using terms from thermodynamics and chaos theory from science and applying it to businesses. Because basically, you know, the way science has learned to describe the way nature works, well, human beings are part of nature. We're, you know, a species, and these same patterns emerge with us and the way we work. And so she's the one who got me thinking about, so when she talks about, you know, chaos theory, so chaos isn't in science, it's not total craziness, but chaos is something that they were looking at particles, right? So a chaotic particle is one that moves, but you can't predict where it's going to be at any certain moment in time. It doesn't follow a predictable pattern. But the interesting thing about chaos theory and chaos science is they started studying particle movements, supposedly chaotic particles, over time, and they found that patterns emerged. It's just there were variations each time. So while you couldn't predict the very next, you know, where any point thing would be at any given point in time, there was a general kind of pattern that was going on over time.
Yes.
And I think that's really important for us in business to understand, and the way people work together, whether it's community, whether you call it an organization, a business, whatever, a club, is that people do this, right? We operate, and it's not important for our businesses. We're moving into the future. We're trying new things. We don't need to know the exact time and place we're going to be 2 years from now. But we do need to know generally what kind of activities produce what kinds of results, what kinds of patterns, so that we can be kind of orbiting in that area. So I thought that was a very interesting concept to think about it. And later that led me to find Dave Snowden's work on the Kinevin framework. Are you familiar with this? Not a lot of people
are. Vaguely. Yeah, vaguely.
So Dave Snowden's a specialty on complexity, and he also has his own way of talking about how we deal with chaotic environments. And he describes, the Kinevin framework is like, if it's a very simple system, how to act and respond, if it's a complicated system, if it's a complex system, and if it's a chaotic system. And without going into the whole thing, because that's a topic for another day, he talks about whenever you're in a very chaotic type system where things are very unpredictable and what you do one day won't have the same result as what you do another day. He talks about you have to take this process of creating safe to fail experiments that have, you know, very little risk if they go wrong, and because you've designed them that way on purpose, and then just taking action and seeing what happens, and then taking a little more action, knowing that you're not going to create some like complicated system that, you know, you're not going to have some automated funnel, but you're going to test and experiment and try things out. And that's like where the most innovation happens. That's where like things start to emerge and you start to discover things. And people are uncomfortable in that kind of area. They're not used to working in that dynamic situation, partly right because of the school problem we keep coming back to, right? Maybe this the public school system.
I got another one about the school system. A client of mine, Ross Jeffries, he has a business where he teaches men how to meet, mate, and date with women. So one of the biggest requests he gets is they want to know where they can find the collection of all his language patterns, like all the pickup lines, the conversational themes, and what have you, so they could memorize them word for word. He eventually, reluctantly, allowed for a curated collection of them to be sold. And because he was responding to public demand and the fact that a lot of people were willing to give him money for it. And he put within the language of it that the caveat was, is there was no guarantee on this, because simply knowing the words is not enough. Okay. Understanding tonality, understanding vibe, and most of all, understanding calibration is what makes this stuff work or doesn't, for a very simple reason. You get somebody who memorizes a pickup line and then enters a dynamic or conversation with somebody where they're trying to get to know them. It's predicated on the idea that the person you're using this line with or doing this opener with is going to have the response you want them to have.
Right, right.
It leaves out that other person is a chaotic human being full of wild chemicals that sees the world through his or her own truth based on their own experiences. And just because that pickup line you used has worked the past five times doesn't mean you ain't going to get slapped this time, or vice versa.
That's right.
So that's
such a good example. I love that, because there's so much going on in that moment, like in a live human interaction. They aren't predictable. And you have to become a true expert in perceiving all the nuances before you can get any sort of predictable result.
Yeah, which is why it was with great reluctance that he even sold that collection, and he curated it very carefully. A few people bought it, said, but I remember you taught this pattern at the Los Alamos seminar in 1997. It's not there, so this isn't really a language pattern collection. Well, that was 1997.
Yeah.
We're in 2022. A lot of things have changed when it comes to everything, including the whole process of meeting people. I think you and I are both just old enough to remember that if one of us had met a dating partner or a boyfriend or a girlfriend or a novio or a novia off the internet, that we would tell a cover story to our family and friends because we didn't want to be seen as those weirdos who were meeting people online.
Yeah, that was a weird
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, I remember those days. And now we've gotten to the point where telling them that you met them in the produce section at the grocery store, it's like,
what?
Whoa. What? Isn't that kind of creepy to just go up to somebody and have a conversation with them in a grocery store? That's how much it shifted within our lifetimes.
It's shifted a lot.
It may shift again.
It probably will. I mean, I think, you know, I've done a lot of work in marketing, obviously. And when I talk about like marketing, it's like human psychology plus whatever communication flavor is the flavor of today, like whatever the context of that is. But the human psychology piece doesn't really change, but how we go about communicating has changed a lot, and it's continuing to change. And people are finding, you know, the amount that they want this kind of asynchronous communication and the amount that they don't, right? Because we don't want to always be asynchronous, or we'll feel quite disconnected. But it's good to also take advantage of the things that being asynchronous, I'm an introvert, and so I love asynchronous.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So,
yes.
I'm like, this is awesome. My mom's also an introvert. And when the pandemic first started, she's like, I'll be fine as long as it doesn't go much past Thanksgiving, right? That was already like 9 months into the future. Everybody else is like freaking out. Like, is it going to be a month or two? Of course, it lasted more than one Thanksgiving, unfortunately. But, you know, that's a true introvert. She's like, I'll be fine staying at home for at least 9 months. No problem.
Well, I have... There are different people who have different opinions about whether there should have been any restrictions at all. And we're not a political podcast, so I'm not going to get into that. But I will confess, and to this day, that I duck out of a lot of invitations by saying, you know, the bug.
Yeah. There you go. There you go.
So I think if we can take some of what we've shared today and we can focus it properly, we can maximize impact, reduce that overwhelm, and feel less burned out. So seeing as we are at the top of the hour, we kind of do have to cap it off. And I know that you have an invitation for our listeners. It's real simple to visit your website at www.pivotground.com. That's www.pivotground.com. And you can discover so much about the impact method. There are some great resources there. I'm going to have to check out a few of those myself. They seem pretty interesting to me. And with that, Sarah Olivieri, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been an honor and, believe me, an education.
Thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure and a fun journey of a conversation. I love what you said about mastermind conversations, right? And the yes. truth of so much business is that it's messy and all over the place.
Yes.
It's not, you know, everybody wants orderly, but that's not really how it goes.
We trust you enjoyed today's episode of the Business Creators Radio Show. Check out our previous and upcoming episodes on our website at www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com. While you're there, be sure to subscribe via your favorite network so you get fresh episodes delivered straight to you. Until next time, have a great day. Take care.